classes and there was oppression, and let's say one class governing the other, or these types of things that are occurring, these social maladies that have happened in the society. No, it was not about that. Those were problems, definitely. But Imam Ali alayhi salam says the main problem that the communities were facing was a spiritual vacuum that the prophets came to fill it and overcome it, so that people can now, with that internal strength, come and apply the right forms of principles that will create that change. Rather, to quench the actual thirst that exists within them. And then the social political issues are actually an offshoot of those issues, those actual spiritual issues. And of course, we discussed about this, it's because these material issues are not this material world and the material amenities is not the aim. Because even if when people achieve them, they still find there's something else missing. Even if they have the best political system, and they might call it the best justice system, but still they feel that there's something wrong. There is something missing. So the problem actually needs to be solved from the core, and that is the spiritual matters. And that is what the prophets came for. And that's how they tried to create change in the communities.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when we talk about the fact that the prophets came to create an internal revolution in the hearts of the people, which was actually a prerequisite for the external revolution in the society, we are talking about this with firm basis, because we say that the actual needs, the actual state that a person feels poor, the true poverty that exists is not the external poverty, it's the poverty that a person feels in the soul, when the community feels that it lacks a true purpose, when it feels that it is not going anywhere, it's just growing but it's not becoming anything. It's growing but it's not showing any fruits. Even the fruits and the flowers that are coming out from it are not real, they are just fake. It's not actually satisfying that need that exists within. So then comes the prophetic mission of showing them what they really need within, and that is the spiritual closeness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to spiritual matters. And we notice that in human society, when we look at the societies today, even today as an example, we can take different communities where revolutions have happened, and we'll see the same happening. You see, many revolutions happened in the 1900s, especially against colonialism and imperialism. And you can say that those communities were, those revolutions were good, and they created a positive change and a positive atmosphere in the world. But more important than that is the Islamic revolution that occurred in Iran, because of various obvious reasons. You see, in Iran, we didn't have imperial rule. There was no country that ruled over Iran in a colonial manner. They used their pawns and their stooges to rule, but at the end of the day, it was apparently an independent country. So you cannot say that the social condition of colonial rule was the reason behind a revolution in Iran. You cannot say that. For the other communities, you can say it. For example, in Africa or in Asia, there were communities under the yoke of imperialism, and they therefore fought that imperialism. And people could argue that maybe because they wanted to be free, they came and fought, and they performed that revolution. But in Iran, it was something beyond that. There were some other reasons that caused that revolution. It didn't fit in the equation that the Western world had placed for their for changes that occur in the society. And this is something important that we need to analyze today.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, coming back to our discussion, we are going to give an example in history, in present-day history, to see that the actual reason why people need to change or to form a revolution needs to be something spiritual. Let me give you examples. There are communities today that, because of economic reasons or political reasons, they perform their revolutions. But we see that today those communities are not happy. Or those revolutions have died down. Or they have been swallowed by a higher or more powerful, let's say, hegemonic rule above them. You can see that in history today. Look at all those revolutions that happened against colonialism. Where are those countries today? Many of them are facing economic problems, social problems, difficulties, and they are not satisfied by the status quo. They have been overwhelmed by higher powers and authorities. You can see communism got destroyed. Today capitalism is in the brink of destruction. And all those countries that are kind of under that umbrella of imperialism are also swaying from here to there. They are not satisfied. Even those communities, even those countries that are at the peak of material development, look at their suicide rates only. You know, the Scandinavian countries, let's say, that they say that they have the most satisfaction in terms of material amenities. Look at them. The suicide rates are high. Look at other communities where people are intellectually strong, where their social systems and the structures are good, the welfare system is excellent, but yet people are not satisfied. What is the reason? So all those political changes and maneuvers that they made because of political, social, material reasons, they realized that those were not the real cause for the pain that existed in the society. And there is something else. And for that, we shall give you the example of the Islamic Revolution as a live example to show that the actual need of the communities today is spiritual in nature. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
While campaigning in the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden vowed to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Once in the White House, he approved the release of a CIA assessment that concluded that bin Salman had ordered the operation that led to Khashoggi's killing. That said, in mid-July, Biden met with bin Salman in Jeddah, a meeting meant to reset the relationship between the two. And a few months later, despite all the ups and downs, the U.S. decided to shield the Saudi crown prince from lawsuits for his role in the killing.
Mr. President?
Yes.
You're coming under a lot of fire for your fist bump with the crown prince. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that. But also, how can you be sure that another incident, another murder like Jamal Khashoggi won't happen again?
God love you. What a silly question. How could I possibly be sure of any of that? I just made it clear, if anything occurs like that again, they'll get that response and much more.
The fact is, Washington has been quietly extracting concessions from the diplomatically isolated prince who has control over Saudi petrodollars. Just weeks before the ruling, Saudi Arabia launched a series of initiatives apparently to win Washington's favor once again. For example, at a meeting of the UN General Assembly in October, the Saudis voted in favor of a Washington-led resolution declaring Russia's annexation of swaths of eastern Ukraine illegal.
So the president is going to strategically think through what the review process is and how we move forward with this relationship. He's going to take his time to consult with members of both parties, with partners, allies, and with the Saudis as well. We've taken note since the OPEC Plus cut that Saudi Arabia voted against Russia at the United Nations and also pledged $4 million to support Ukraine's reconstruction and humanitarian needs.
The Saudis also played a key role in brokering a high-profile prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine, in which some UK and US citizens who had been captured fighting for the Ukrainian military were freed. Since the murder of Khashoggi, the US has threatened the Saudis with holding or suspending arms deals. But in reality, suspending arms sales has been a far-off possibility. This past August, following his trip to Saudi Arabia, Biden approved over $3 billion in weapons sales. In fact, Saudi Arabia has been the U.S.'s biggest weapons buyer for a decade. Such deals have always worked as hush money received by a country that has made human rights the glossy cover of its foreign policy rhetoric.
If you look in terms of dollars, $3 billion, $533 million, $525 million, that's peanuts for you. Should have increased it. $880 million, $645 million, $6 billion, that's for frigates. $889 million, $63 million, and that's for various artillery.
The lavish purchases bin Salman has made not only from Western arms industries, but industries across the board, from technology to sports and entertainment to investment banking and construction, have been designed to rehabilitate him on the global scene.
It is an opportunity to reaffirm the strength of our strategic relationship. We will be signing important agreements, and we will have an opportunity to further discuss regional developments. But how to further cement this important relationship between our two countries, placing a particular emphasis on economic cooperation.
I believe we have also historical opportunities that we're going to finalize a lot of it today, linking the grid of electricity, which we can provide Greece and Southwest Europe through Greece with much cheaper renewable energy. And we're going to sign the MOU about that today. Also, we are working about hydrogen and how to turn Greece as a hub for Europe to hydrogen. That's a game changer for both of us.
In just another case, back in April, a Turkish court confirmed transferring the Khashoggi case to Saudi Arabia. 2 months later, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan met bin Salman. the strongest sign yet of a turnaround in relations since 2018. Now, Turkey is expecting Saudi Arabia to deposit up to $20 billion into Turkish treasury bonds and accounts in an effort to boost the economically struggling country's foreign currency reserves. When several lobbying and public relations firms terminated their contracts with Saudi Arabia following Khashoggi's murder, the kingdom doubled down on the firms that remained on its payroll. In just the first 6 weeks after Khashoggi was killed, Corvus Communications, the long-serving PR agency for the kingdom in America, received nearly $18 million from the Saudi government. Saudi Arabia also gifted close to $270 million to 144 American universities in 2019, and a total of $440 million since the death of Jamal Khashoggi, and these numbers do not include funds yet to be paid out. Years since Khashoggi's dismemberment and disappearance from the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, the rehabilitation of the Saudi crown prince is complete. Biden, after pledging on the 2020 campaign trail to make Saudi Arabia a pariah, traveled to the country in a visit that gave bin Salman the legitimacy he longed for. And the human rights concerns do appear in summaries of the leaders of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, but hardly rise to the level of a top priority for Biden's foreign policy team.
What was the Crown Prince's response to your comments about Khashoggi?
He basically said that he was not personally responsible for it. I indicated I thought he was. He said he was not personally responsible for it, and he took action against those who were responsible. And then I went on to talk more about how that dealing with any opposition to the or criticism of the Saudi administration in other countries was viewed as, to me, a violation of human rights.
For the U.S., the money in Saudi Arabia is too big to ignore, and the Saudi crown prince knows that very well. He has spent billions of the kingdom's petrodollars to erase the stigma of a murder, and the leader of the so-called free world seems happy with it.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Tour the pit.
On Youth Station.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world I hope you're all doing well This is your station
Yes
yeah,
Once
and we
more.
Are here again And I'm really glad that I'm here How about you, my dear sister Asma?
Yes, I'm over-exhilarated
We are coming back to our hometown, our generation And our beautiful connection to you As you know, 50 years ago, many children were responsible for helping on the family, like, I don't know, going under heavy responsibility, like caring for younger siblings and, I don't know, working at a young age and so on. And as you know...
Whenever I just hear these things, I remember Charles Dickens, David Copperfield.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was thinking of that. And as you know, the responsibilities were kind of, you know, seemed heavier than today. But as you know, it seems like today the children are growing faster.
You know what? I say even right now, children are going through the same thing that children were going through 50 years ago, but the appearance has changed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm telling you that when we were younger, because time is flying and it's in such a rapid that we cannot even grasp everything that happens in each decade.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you that when I was a kid, then I had all the facilities to be a child, you know, to act like a child, to go for a different entertainment and whatever. But I also would think that maybe I have grown faster than what I should have.
So you're telling me that the cultural atmosphere is kind of putting a pressure on you to feel like that?
No. You know what I say? No. I say it depends on your personality.
Ah. If it depended on the personality, it wouldn't be that much, you know, spread it out.
Yeah. See, because there are different causes. One of them is your personality. The other one is your family. The other one is society. The other one is...
How about our strong alliance in technology?
Of course. Of course. Because we have seen it right now, you know. I have two nieces. And then when I look at them, I just see, oh my God, they're not children.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like, okay, who are you? Are you, for example, 5 years old? I can't believe that.
I can't believe that.
I have the same feeling about them. And I think the problem is somehow the access to whatever they want, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think they have more knowledge than they should.
But also, I would say there's another thing, you know? They don't have siblings. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
they're one, and at most they're two. And then they have to live with plenty much of people around them that are all old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Above 30, at least. I'm not calling all the above 30 people as old. But I'm just saying that the people that they are coping up with are all from older generation.
Yeah. I myself was from these kind of situation too.
Yeah, you understand what I say.
Yeah, exactly. Because
you know, when I was a child, I had four more of children with myself at home. So just imagine the situation. We're all children. We have different experiences. And every single one of us has to share their experiences with each other. And then we go for crimes together. And that's different.
Yeah, it is different. So I have the same situation that I will elaborate to after a short break. So then we go for a short break, then we'll come back again. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Youth Station, and we're talking about something really interesting. As you know, we feel like children are growing too fast. And at the last part, we're talking about our own experience for these kind of situations. Mm-hmm. That I just told you that I want to elaborate my own situation for you. You know, I was an only child for 10 years. And after
such a long time.
Yeah, in both, actually, family, my maternal and paternal families, I was only one child. And after 10 years, my sister came.
And, wow.
Yeah. And for 10 years, I've experienced this kind of situation that all the people around me were adults.
Yeah.
And, you know, I felt like, okay, I'm adult too. I'm an adult too. Why not me? Mm-hmm. Why can't I do this? Why can't I tell this? Why can't I, for example, participate in this decision?
Exactly. And you know, you would say something else as well. You would say that there is no way for me to do a mistake.
Exactly.
I have to be perfect.
Yeah. And this perfectionism that I have, actually, I admit that I have it, I think comes from this point that a family environment. But I think there is another thing which leads to maturing so fast. And this is the healthy environment and nutrition that we have nowadays. As you know, the hormones and the kind of industrial food that we are eating, we are using, is the problem.
Yeah. Well, I can't relate much to that point.
You cannot relate that because, as you know, we are facing precocious puberty in our young generation, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And the problem is the hormones. that we are eating, actually. And this is the relation between them. And these hormones,
the foods and
yeah,
the fruits
exactly.
that we're taking in are no longer the organic
yeah.
things that we used to eat.
And because their body and they are changing physically to the adulthood, but their minds actually exist in the childhood, they will kind of feel a kind of paradoxical content in this issue.
Exactly.
And they will act as adults.
Yeah.
This is the problem.
And, you know, I was reading something. Again, it was psychological, and it said that the children that are growing faster beyond their age and beyond their years, then when they grow up, they're going to face some traumas.
Exactly.
Likewise, like, for example, a child who has never felt like a child when he or she was a kiddo, then as they grow older, they will have this problem of being fastidious toward this making decisions. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They would pick things very hardly.
And let me tell you something, even this kind of unfortunate thing will lead to some psychological disorders, you know.
Of course.
When they grow up, because they haven't experienced the childhood that much, they will have some special tendency that are strange.
Yeah,
for example,
yeah.
they collect some strange things.
Exactly.
You know, some some strange collectioners in the world that we are actually watching and observing is, you know, they all have some roots in their childhood, these kind of problems.
Yeah, exactly.
And even crimes.
Yeah, of course.
Know, because they feel they lack something.
See, I would say this is the rule. When you go too extreme in everything, there comes all the problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So balance is something we
balance
need.
Balance is very
everything.
Good.
Everything is the key.
Now, Vita, let's talk about the role of parents in these things.
I'm not a parent.
Okay, at least you can imagine
easily,
that.
I always skip it. Yeah. I know. Actually, the parent rule is the most important thing, I think, in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you cannot tell me that, okay, because the nutrition is is full of hormones, you are facing this prematuring, and you cannot do anything for that. No. The most effect is effect and impact is from the family part.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things, there is a beautiful thing that I want to read to you. This intentional balance of freedom and boundaries is exactly what children need to feel like they can still act like a kid while developing a sense of independence and autonomy at an appropriate rate.
Yeah.
This is a quote from a professional
psychologist.
Yeah, a psychologist. And I think it was beautiful.
Yeah.
You have to make a balance. Sometimes the boundaries that you are putting on the children will make them and lead them to doing something that is not appropriate for their age.
See, Vita, when we were children, I remember that there were among the relatives, you know, there were some parents who forced their children, for example, not to touch something or not to go somewhere, not to do this or not to do that. When I saw them, I just felt like, as I grew older, I understood actually that those parents were the actual hindrance in the way of their children's creativity.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For example, when I was a child, it was so hard to control my tendencies towards art. You know what I mean?
Oh. Nice.
Well, I had to play with too much of colors and painting.
So.
And then, I you know, when you have a child
I
like that.
I thought you were a bookworm.
Yes, I was and I am.
Thank
but
you.
Then, you know, art is something that, that I cannot forget about. So imagine you have a child like that. It is so difficult to control those children because then they would do something wrong and they would play with the mods or whatever. Dirty things, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
So being a mother.
Troublemakers.
Being a mother, tolerating this situation is very difficult. But now when I think of my mother, I think she was very good at doing that.
You have to be patient, you know? I think
patience is a very good thing.
Yeah.
You know? Then you would actually let your children grow in their creativity and grow in their manners even.
Yeah.
You know, even the fact that I told you, now you said that I was the only child in both my paternal and maternal family. So this is very difficult. But as for us, when we gathered in my grandmother's house, there were a crowd of children.
Yeah.
There was a hustle and bustle of all these children around each other. So that actually is going to help you grow better.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So even if we are parenting children that are lonely children, we have to take them to some occasions and situations in which they could meet their fellows, you know?
Yeah.
They could have this interaction with other people of their same age because that is going to help them grow in a much healthier way.
Nice one. You know, so we're going to talk more about the solutions of this problem after a short break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is
Youth Station.
And we are here talking about
growing faster than your early age.
Exactly. And we wanted to have some just solutions. I want you to just tell me in summary, what are your own solutions if you were a parent?
Well, I would say as a child, I would do everything that I think is proper to do. And then as a parent, I would let my child to go for whatever. See, as a child, whatever. Until the age of seven, I would say whatever.
Yeah.
But actually not whatever, like, for example, as you see, nowadays children go for breaking the TV or, I don't know, they do some harsh things.
Not violent.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. The things that are healthy and not violent, then I would let my child do that. I would try to practice being patient more and more. I would even maybe be a partner with them in all the crimes they do.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That would be a really beautiful house. I want to come.
Yes, and you're welcome. You can come anytime you like.
And, you know, I want to end this, actually, our beautiful conversation with my own experience. When I was a child, I was really interested in scissors and something, and cutting the papers. Yeah, and, you know, my mother, like kind of exceptions, just allowed me to use the scissor from a young age, like 3 years old. Something, even if it exists in the danger of cutting my fingers and so on.
Yeah.
But she allowed it. And, you know, I think it really helped me to grow this kind of creativity and productivity in myself.
Of course. And now you become a doctor.
Thank you.
You can also use that scissor.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know why I like scissors. And
because you're a doctor.
I will be. And, you know, I think you have to find the balance limitation between this kind of freedom and authority that you have and you have to put on your children, you know.
Exactly.
And when you find this balance, everything will be
And solved. Don't force your children into being something that they aren't. For example, you have seen it that some people force their children to go study medicine. Yeah.
Mostly medicine in... I don't know, in countries like India,
in developing
Iran.
Countries, you
yeah,
know?
Developing countries.
In developing countries, being a doctor or being the engineer or even lawyer is the final thing a parent would love their children to be.
It's the paradise. Your future will be like paradise and something, but it won't.
You found salvation. But that's not the whole truth, you know?
Exactly.
Do not force your children to be something that they aren't.
Find your talent.
Yeah. And let them be creative.
And lead them to that road.
Exactly.
They will be successful.
Don't let them be wasted.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's all. I guess that's the gist.
You're talking so painfully. Why?
No, I'm just talking based on experience, you know?
Yeah. It's experience-based. It's like always like that you feel it from your bone that, okay, you have to do that. Because
exactly.
It's the right way.
Yeah.
So...
like always, time is flying so fast.
Yeah, exactly. At the end, we are human beings with limited sources, so we have to find the right way to go for our future.
And then go.
And our brilliant talents and go through that road. This is the solution. Thank you for listening to us. I hope that was...
a fruitful session for all of you.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have a very special guest speaker, Dr. Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
One of the rituals of the Muslims is doing tayammum. We can say, which we have to be more familiar with in your speech, inshallah. But one major question is that tayammum on a dirty dust or a dirty soil, isn't it in contradiction with the nature of Islam, which encourages, we can say, health and hygiene very much?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that for some of the rituals, we are in need of kind of purity. And that purity is mainly through ablution, wudu, the minor ablution, yes, and the major ablution that is called ghusl. But in some cases, in different cases which are mentioned in the books of jurisprudence, people may have no access to water, or the water might be harmful. And for other scenarios, they need to do tayammum instead of wudu or ghusl. And for tayammum, you are in need of some soil. And of course, it can be a piece of rock and a stone as well. But we are in need of the soil. Now, the question is whether it is, as you mentioned, in line with the Islamic instructions about hygiene and health. So first of all, we need to refer to the fact that when it comes to Islamic laws, some people think that we know all the philosophies and wisdoms for the Islamic laws. This is not the case. For some of the Islamic laws, the philosophies are mentioned in the narration of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, but still it doesn't mean that the full philosophy is mentioned. So yes, ablution helped wudu may help the people for purification of the body, for hygiene. But is ablution wudu only for this purpose? Not necessarily. There might be other philosophies that we are not aware of. So this is a general point when it comes to the philosophies of Islamic laws. Of course, we do believe that all of them are based on wisdom, divine wisdom, but it doesn't mean that we may know all the philosophies. To the extent that they are mentioned in the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt, we may find the philosophies, but we cannot go beyond that. This is one point as a kind of introduction. Now, having said that, is tayammum against hygiene? The point is that, first of all, who has claimed that to do tayammum, to have a kind of touching with the soil, is going to bring you, dirt and make you
unclean. Yes.
In that case, we should claim that all the workers who are always busy and dealing with the soil in the construction, they should be always in the hospitals. It's not the case. Mm-hmm. According to some, they even might be stronger than other people. Okay. So in and of itself, we cannot claim that touching the soil would bring you any kind of disease. And the second point is that according to the science, even if you have clean and dry soil, it is immune to the germs and microbes. And it is well documented in today's scientific discoveries. And also they mentioned that there are some particles inside the soil that they are able to remove the germs too. That is why if you imagine of a carrion of a corpse which is put under the soil after a few days, it would be demolished completely. And one of the reasons is that the soil is able to remove all the germs and microbes in that body.
That's right.
So if you have a dry...
Even soil can be used as a cleaner in Islam,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's right. I will come to that. I mean, yes. When it comes to...
The tools of cleaning.
A dish which is impure because of a dog, for example, one of the ways is to use soil for purifying that dish. So my point is that the dry and the clean soil, even according to discoveries of today's science, is not only is not a factor for uncleanliness, rather it is able to remove the germs. And the next point is that the verse talking about the concept of tayammum, which is in chapter An-Nisa, verse 43, reads, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم, فَتَيَمَّمُوا صَعِيدًا طَيَّبًا. In this verse, the word which is used as a kind of as a kind of attribute and feature for that soil is طَيَّب, meaning that it should be
a clean one,
yes. A pure one. And that is why I'm repeating my point is that a clean, dry soil is free of any kind of germ and even it's able of removing the germs and microbes. And not only that, we have some narrations in this regard. In Wasa'il al-Shia, there is a chapter called Kirahatu Tayammum Bituraban Yuta wa Turabat Tariq. It is makruh, it is disliked for you to do tayammum through a soil which is, in the alleys, in the streets, and people walk on it, it is disliked. And there is a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that do not use for tayammum the soil that people may walk on it. So all these narrations are referring to the fact that, and that verse in the chapter An-Nisa, verse 43, that the soil which is used for tayammum should be a clean one.
Yes.
And at least it is disliked for the people to use a dirty soil for tayammum.
And how can we distinguish? Is it whether it is clean or dirty? By dirty and clean, you mean ethically speaking or no? Or you mean Islamically speaking?
No, I mean physically speaking.
It is touched by an impure thing.
No, I mean physically speaking, we may find soil in the alleys, in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
But the other point is that we may go to a clean jungle, clean desert, and find a soil which is not trodden by any person, by any animal. And
okay.
Some people do that. They bring some clean soil from some places where no human and no animal has ever been. And it's absolutely a clean, dry soil. And in that case, they may bring it to their home and use it for, all the cases that they are in need of doing tayammum.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
And I think you also refer to this point that nowadays we have a treatment that is called soil treatment.
Yes.
And based on that, some of the illnesses...
Soil therapy.
Exactly.
Yes.
They believe that through the soil, again, dry, clean soil, they are able to remove and get rid of some of the diseases and germs and microbes. The next point is that when we are practicing tayammum, for tayammum, we touch the soil and then we rub the our two hands on the forehead and on the two hands.
Yes.
On the backside of the hands. First of all, when you're touching the forehead, it doesn't mean that we need to, touch our eyes and the whole face with the soil. Mm-hmm. No, it is only on the forehead. Of course, for the details, the dear listeners may refer to the books of Islamic laws. So my point is that there is no touching. The eyes are not going to touch the soil. And second of all, not only that, it's been mentioned that for tayammum, if you touch the soil and there are some particles of the soil in on your hand, you are able to remove those particles as well. And the next point is that tayammum is not limited only to soil. If you do not like it, the other option is, for example, the stone or the rock. So you may have a clean
piece of stone.
And do the tayammum through that stone.
Do we have any verse or ayah of the Holy Quran referring to tayammum?
Verse 43 of chapter An-Nisa explicitly talks about the concept of tayammum, in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَتَيَمَّمُوا صَعِيدًا طَيَّبًا. For some scenarios in which you are not able to use water for ablution, major or minor ones, then you need to do tayammum through using sa'idan soil, which is tayyib, which is pure, which is clean, free of any kind of impurity. And at the last point, let me go back to the first point that I mentioned. I repeat that some of the philosophies of the Islamic laws are mentioned in the narrations, but it doesn't mean that this is the whole philosophy. I would like to add some more points on this in this regard. So, for example, as I mentioned, it is true that making ablution can help us regarding hygiene and purification of the body. But is it the whole philosophy? As I mentioned, no. There might be many other philosophies. The second point is that, even if imagine that the whole philosophy of ablution is a purity of the body, which is not the case, but let's suppose that this is the case. What about the order? Why do we wash the face first, and then the right hand, and then the left hand, and all the details which are there for minor ablution? The same is true for the major ablution. Yes. Okay, if it is only for purification of the body, there shouldn't be any order. There shouldn't be all these details that are mentioned for wudu, for ablution, minor ablution, for ghusl, the major ablution, and for tayammum. Why there is a kind of order to rub the face and then the right hand and the left hand, and so on and so forth. So my point is that, of course, we do not believe that these are anti-reason. We believe that these are beyond the understanding of the human intellect. So although we may find some of the philosophies of some of the Islamic laws based on the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalam, they are not the only philosophies, because I mentioned, not all the details can be discovered by today's science. Okay, so for example, fasting, according to the science, can be a tool for health. For some people, they can
get doing intermittent fasting nowadays.
They can get rid of some of the diseases through fasting. But what about all the details which are mentioned in the narrations of the Ahl Bayt about fasting? Is health the only philosophy for fasting? Of course not. We just can claim that it can be one of the philosophies for ablution. Purity of the body, cleanliness can be one of the philosophies, but it's not the only philosophy. There might be many other philosophies that we are not aware of.
Thank you much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration. Thank you much, Sheikh Karimi. It was very kind of you. Really, I enjoyed talking to you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husayin wa hasan.
الجمال إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll examine the relationship between Germany's political establishment and the Zionist regime. This relationship extends to Die Linke, that was founded in 2007 as a left-wing alternative to Germany's SPD. But Die Linke's leadership has been very hostile to the concept of justice for the Palestinian people. Rather than being the radical left-wing alternative it claimed to be when it was established, is Die Linke more concerned with maintaining the political status quo in Germany? I'll be talking to experts to find out after this special report by Latifa Abouchakra about how Germany has responded to the existence of the Zionist entity.
Germany is hostile territory for Palestine. It is the only place in the world outside Palestine where it is effectively illegal to wave a Palestinian flag. Earlier this year, the Berlin police banned all pro-Palestine demonstrations, including the Nakba commemoration, and a protest at the Israeli murder of Shireen Abu Akleh. But why is Germany so backwards in its attitude to Palestine? The traditional response given is that the Germans are still trying to atone for the Nazi genocide against the Jews. But on the same day that riot police swooped on Neukölln and detained or stopped at least 170 people during the afternoon and evening of Nakba Day, by contrast, neo-Nazi admirers of Hitler's regime were free to meet and fly the German imperial flag. They were left unmolested. So something more fundamental is going on. Over the years, Zionist leaders have met with German counterparts, starting with the first Chancellor of West Germany after the 1939-45 war, Konrad Adenauer, and carrying on ever since. In 2008, Merkel addressed the Knesset, saying that Germany had a special responsibility for the security of Israel. In 2019, the German parliament voted to condemn BDS as anti-Semitic. Underlying this capture of German foreign and domestic policy by the Zionists is the influence of the US and the failure of denazification after the war. NATO was a means to contain both the Soviet Union and Germany in US interests. Declassified files show that the State Department intelligence saw NATO as a place to help West Germany satisfy its reasonable aspirations and contain any potential unreasonable ones. In addition, the CIA actively set up the intelligence service of West Germany, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, known as the BND. The CIA knew that the head of the agency general, Reinhard Gehlen, was a former Nazi and approved his appointment, even though he employed numerous former Nazis and known war criminals. He was, of course, a CIA operative. Gehlen made contact with Mossad in 1957, and in 1967, an ex-Nazi officer in Gehlen's group passed on information to Mossad on Syria and Egypt, enabling Israel to destroy a large part of the Egyptian and Syrian air forces with a preemptive strike. Gehlen also maintained a network of compliant journalists, as a trove of recently leaked files shows. A network of compliant scribblers and informants was set up in the editorial offices of Germany and deployed time and time again to directly influence politicians and policies. Put in the context of the significant number of paid CIA assets in the German media, as revealed by the writer Udo Ulf Kotten, It is no surprise that the German political system, intelligence, and media are united in their support for Israel's crimes.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Phil Bevan. Phil worked in the Leader of the Opposition's office under Jeremy Corbyn. He's researched the role of the German left, and he's written a number of articles about how the Labour Party and the left more generally in the UK have been subverted. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you if I can. What more can you tell us about this character, Galen, the Nazi intelligence chief, who ended up running the West German intelligence service?
It's a fascinating tale. So he's head of Nazi counterintelligence, well, you know, one of the key areas, and he's then recruited by the CIA immediately at the end of the war, and the CIA makes sure that he is then placed, his network of intelligence network is then placed into West Germany. He becomes the head of West German foreign intelligence, and he remains there. He dies peacefully in his bed in 1979, and he remains there for some considerable time. The only reason he has to leave the intelligence organization is because his deputy is discovered to be a Soviet spy. So we have an organization which is run in post-war West Germany, run by a Nazi. He's disavowed Nazism, but he goes straight from being a Nazi intelligence officer through to being a CIA asset and into German intelligence. Now, does this mean that the German intelligence organization for the post-war period was effectively run by the CIA? Well, it looks a little bit like that.
Interesting. I mean, Phil, this Galen was also recruited, I understand, by the CIA, wasn't he? And what do you think the significance of this is for understanding German politics?
I think it's very significant, actually, because, yes, he was recruited by the CIA. He was also paid by the CIA to do his work. And although he was not the head of the SS intelligence, and it was military intelligence that he was in charge of, privately, he maintained his anti-Semitic views. So he conducted his organization in line with those views as well. He also did hire former SS officers into positions within the German intelligence service. And just to be clear, it's not like this was really a new organization. What really happened is that the CIA employed Galen's existing organization that was in place under the Nazis to run the post-war German intelligence service, which was then called the Galen organization, but became the BND. And effectively, they're the same thing. And we've seen the consequences of this in more recent years. There was still very close cooperation between the BND and the Americans. For example, in 2014, it was revealed that the US, the NSA, had been working with the BND to wiretap and listen in to German politicians. So the question is whether or not the BND is working primarily for the German state, or in fact the US state, and I don't think that has been properly addressed yet.
Right.
And also how much, right-wing, far-right politics still plays in the organisation and has historically played in the organisation. Yes.
Well, let me just go to David. I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of people would be interested in is why is it Germany is so pro-Zionist? I mean, do you think it's just simply guilt, or what are the reasons?
Well, there's a sense in which the guilt's part of it, and it's the way in which the guilt becomes part of the political culture, which is important. But also, of course, the relationship with Americans and the very early on relationship between Galen and the Mossad. So he contacts the Mossad in the 50s, and they have a really quite close relationship from that point on. And that's part of the tale as well. So that in 1967, you have the intelligence about the Egyptian and the Syrian Air Force being passed through an ex-Nazi officer in Galen's organization to the Mossad, which allows the Israeli Defense Force to eliminate effectively the whole of the Egyptian and the Syrian Air Force, and thus allowing them much more easily to occupy the territories which they currently still occupy.
I mean, Phil, would you say it's a stretch to suggest that the BND was effectively an asset then of the CIA? I mean, if so, I mean, do you think it's still an asset of the CIA, in your opinion?
I think it was definitely an asset of the CIA originally. The Galen organization certainly was. And the BND, of course, grew out of that. And I think we shouldn't be drawing too much of a distinction between the two, because Galen also served as the head of the BND after it was renamed. So we're looking at really what is effectively the same organization. And as I mentioned before, there's been very close cooperation with the Americans over the years.